Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the shooting death of an unarmed black man, Walter Scott, by a white police officer in North Charleston, South Carolina, that was captured on a cell phone and has forced the local police to change their story as first reported and charge Officer Michael Slager with murder. Corey Hutchins, the winner of the South Carolina Press Association's Journalist of the Year Award in 2012, joins us to discuss his article in the Daily Beast, Michael Slager's attorney dumped him as soon as he saw the video, and the key role the cell phone video captured by a bystander played in changing the narrative. Then we will speak with Bernard Powers, a professor of history at the College of Charleston, who is the author of Black Charlestonians, A Social History. He joins us to discuss the similarities to Ferguson, Missouri, of the predominantly white police force in the predominantly black community of North Charleston, and the local reaction to the shooting that has sparked protests and renewed the call that Black Lives Matter. Then finally, we will address the issue of the criminalization of poverty and the extent to which it applies in this case of the shooting death of Walter Scott. Karen Dolan, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies who currently coordinates IPS's Economic Hardship Reporting Project with New York Times bestselling author Barbara Ehrenreich, and is the author of a new report, The Poor Get Prison, The Alarming Spread of the Criminalization of Poverty, joins us. And joining us now is Corey Hutchins, a freelance journalist who was a staff writer for the Columbia Free Times, South Carolina's largest weekly newspaper. He was a 2008 winner of the South Carolina Press Association's Award for In-Depth Reporting and was the winner of their Journalist of the Year Award in 2012. He's the author of The Accidental Candidate, about the mystery candidate for the U.S. Senate, Alvin Green. And his latest exclusive, Michael Slager's attorney dumped him as soon as he saw a video, is up now at the Daily Beast. Welcome to Background Briefing, Corey Hutchins.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, thanks, Corey. And the attorney who was briefly Officer Slager's, and Officer Slager, of course, has now been charged with murder for the shooting death of Walter Scott, which was captured on video. But his attorney, who, as you've written about, dumped him as soon as he saw the video. Of course, the attorney did go public last Monday and defended the officer. So is that your sense, that he basically felt that he was lied to?
I'm not sure. I asked him, tried to get at that specific point with him a couple times in our interview. David Ehler is a lawyer. He's a very prominent lawyer, and I'm sure he's a very good lawyer, and he speaks like a lawyer. When I said to him, you know, you were quoted as this officer's attorney in the aftermath of this high-profile shooting, but before the video came out, now that the video came out, you're not his attorney anymore. What happened? Well, he would not specifically say how or when he first saw the video, although he did say that he learned about the video from the media. And it was, he was very specific about sticking to a timeline of events. He said that because of attorney-client privileges, he could not be specific or give, you know, details on any conversations he had with his client, or specifically why he chose not to be his attorney anymore. All he would do was confirm over and over again that immediately after the video became public, he withdrew as this officer's counsel.
And the killing took place on Saturday morning. And later on Saturday, the North Charleston police released a statement alleging that Walter Scott had attempted to gain control of a taser from Officer Slager, and that he was shot in the struggle over the weapon. And that story was carried by the Post Courier, saying that the dead man fought with an officer over his taser before deadly force was employed. And then they added that during the struggle, the man gained control of the taser and attempted to use it against the officer. The officer then resorted to his service weapon and shot him. So that was the story that first came out of the police department, and that's right. The story that was first published in the local press. And then on Monday, the attorney that you spoke to, David Ehler, reinforced that narrative. So then later on, I guess, he was aware of the video. Do you know when the police department were aware of the video?
I don't. And interestingly enough, the officer's former attorney didn't seem to know either. He said that he was not sure who shot the video or how the video came out publicly. And from what I understand, just from reading media reports, it seems like the first place I saw the video was in the New York Times. The video has also come out in the local newspaper's website, the Post and Courier's website. I believe I read somewhere that the bystander who shot the video provided it to the family of the victim, who gave it to his lawyer, who then provided it to authorities and the media. Not sure that I'm actually precise on that timeline, but that's how, you know, that's how I recall seeing that, how that came out. I don't know if we yet know the name of the bystander or the circumstances in which the video was shot. What we do know is that this is one of the rare times when you have a police, the authority narrative, being directly challenged with video evidence. And what's really telling about it is the whole situation with the taser. If you look at that video, and I believe the New York Times even reported that it appears the officer picks up something off the ground that could be a taser, then walks it over and puts it, what looks like, near the body. So, you know, I think it's really hard to kind of keep maybe using that defense when there's video evidence that might dispute that.
And again, I'm speaking with Corey Hutchins, who is a freelance journalist and former staff writer for the Columbia Free Times, South Carolina's largest weekly newspaper. He was the 2008 winner of the South Carolina Press Association's Award for In-Depth Reporting and was the winner of their Journalist of the Year Award in 2012. He's the author of The Accidental Candidate, about the mystery candidacy for the U.S. Senate of Alvin Green. And his latest exclusive is Michael Slager's attorney dumped him as soon as he saw the video, which is up now at The Daily Beast. So I think this really is a classic narrative of what happens when these incidents happen, particularly when they're not videotaped or there's no other evidence and we have to rely on the police's accounting, because immediately they followed the script. The officer appears to have planted the taser, gave his account. The newspaper printed that as though it were fact. The attorney for the officer who you interviewed also added to that narrative. And it was only on Tuesday, after the Saturday morning shooting, that the video emerges, and then everybody suddenly changes their tune.
Yeah, and I'll tell you something else that's interesting about South Carolina in this story, and that's that years ago, there was an incident in a rural county in South Carolina where there was a police-involved shooting, and a newspaper requested the autopsy of the victim. And the autopsy was denied to the press. And at the time, I believe the coroner said something to the effect of that he didn't have to give the autopsy report to the press or the public because it was a medical record, and the coroner considered himself a healthcare provider or something like that. Now, the Press Association of South Carolina have fought this for a while. I think it even went to the South Carolina Supreme Court. I remember the Press Association director telling me one time that anybody who thinks a coroner, anybody who has a healthcare provider who's a coroner must be in pretty bad shape. That's kind of a joke, but I think it underlies a pretty important thing here, because there were, if I remember correctly, allegations that the person was shot in the back, and the press wanted to know whether that was accurate or not, and how would you need to do that? Well, a coroner's report would show it. So, you know, I think state by state, it's different as to whether coroners have to release their reports to the press and public or not. So in absence of something like a video, those reports, when they become public, they can shed light on these instances as well.
But if the video had not surfaced, that might have been the end of the story. There have apparently, according to a study by the state of South Carolina, police in South Carolina have fired their weapons at 209 suspects in the last 5 years, but no police were convicted. I've looked at this video a couple of times, and I imagine you have too, Corey. And it's the casual way in which the officer fires 8 shots in the back of from a distance of about 15 feet initially. It's almost as though the officer was too lazy to chase after this guy. How do you see it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, these situations are obviously tense, right? And I'm clearly not the authority to do any kind of analysis on that situation as a reporter. We'll say that South Carolina is a state where, you know, just recently, a couple months ago, another video came out of South Carolina where an officer shot that guy at a traffic stop at a gas station. And, you know, that was... I believe that was an instance where the officer's own dash cam footage showed what had happened. And that was, you know, a huge national media event as well. So, you know, I don't know if it has something to do with South Carolina as a place or a culture, or if it's more that, you know, with just the technology these days where everybody has a camera, this is something we're going to be seeing more and more of.
Well, but as far as I know, the protocol is that it's actually against the law for police to shoot suspects fleeing the scene. Their duty is to chase them down. And you see that, of course, in endless television shows and movies. And I believe it, as a result of a Supreme Court ruling, my understanding, that is the protocol that stands. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, I believe I've heard that before about the Supreme Court ruling.
So then... why do you think he didn't pursue him? I mean, I guess there's no way to know from a video, right?
I have no idea.
Right.
Clearly, that's a question for the officer and his new attorney, right. Whoever that is.
Right. But it is pretty clear from the video that he does drop the... he goes back and picks up the taser, which was on the ground near where he fired the shots, and then he walks over to the body and then drops it beside it.
That's my understanding from... looking at the video.
Right. And the victim is all sort of trussed up in handcuffs, but sort of, you know, they roll him over like a slab of meat. It doesn't seem there's anybody sort of concerned about his state. Perhaps he was already dead. How does it strike you?
So I thought that part of the video was pretty striking. The guy was, I think there were, 8 shots, and I'm not sure how many hit him. I think he was hit in the ear. He was hit in the back. I believe a bullet actually pierced his heart. And there was, I believe, in the initial reporting on this shooting, back before the video emerged, I believe there was some kind of talk from the authorities that they had performed CPR on the victim. And after, you know, watching the video, I didn't see that happen. So I think that's going to be an emerging question that, you know, the press is going to be asking there in North Charleston. When did that happen? You know, what was the timeline there? There's a few minutes on that video when there are officers standing around. One of the officers checks his pulse. I do wonder about that issue. Did they really perform CPR on the victim or not? And if so, when?
And what we know about the victim is that he's had several run-ins, largely for failure to pay child support. And apparently he was at a pawn shop, and this happened behind a pawn shop, and he was pulled over because he had a broken taillight. Is that your understanding?
Yes.
So having been a longtime resident of South Carolina, Corey Hutchins, how does this strike you in terms of the number of incidents that, of course, Ferguson, Missouri, Staten Island, New York, and now South Carolina, and we know that there's a movement afoot across the country, Black Lives Matter, and that movement has been, obviously, not that it needs to be revived, but it's certainly being inflamed by this incident because it's so graphic and clearly on videotape. And I think, as we all agree, probably we wouldn't even be talking about this had this videotape not been shot. And it's not the same as having police wear their own cameras, which was one of the so-called reforms that came out of some of the incidents that have happened lately. So what's your sense then of this clearly is a national issue as opposed to a local issue? Do you see any elements of systemic racism in South Carolina or in the North Charleston police?
I believe it is safe to say that South Carolina is an area of this country that has a very long, documented, complicated history with race. You brought up the issue of police-worn body cameras. I write for Columbia Journalism Review's United States Project, where we cover how local journalism is being reported across the country, and we report on accountability reporting. One of the issues that I've looked at in my reporting is when police body cam footage becomes public. And, you know, I live in Colorado now. I'm not sure what the process is in South Carolina. I believe it varies state by state. I think that can be a problem. In Colorado, it's up to the local police themselves to decide when that footage becomes public. And I think that these videos that come out, whether they're shot by cameras that are worn on the bodies of the police officers or whether they're shot by bystanders, is certainly going to put a lot more attention to, how this footage makes its way into the public sphere. I think there had been a movement in the past, right, when cell phones started being equipped with cameras a lot and everybody kind of carries a video recording device on them now. There was always this kind of question of whether it was okay to film cops when they're doing their duties, right? And I think that has kind of worked its way through the courts to where we're pretty sure that if you're on public property and you're seeing an officer in an altercation with somebody, you're doing anything, you have the right to film them.
You can actually hear the person who's filming it sort of muttering, you know, with dismay under his breath. It's sort of interesting, too, that neither the police seem to notice this person. So the speculation is that Officer Slager wasn't aware that he was being videotaped.
I asked his former attorney if he knew whether Officer Slager knew somebody was taping the incident. And the attorney said that he could not say whether the client did or did not. You know, he couldn't really talk about what kind of conversations he had with his client. But the attorney said he was not aware that there was a video until it kind of came out publicly. So, you know, that just kind of raises a whole bunch of questions, right? If you watch the footage, it almost seems like the officer does, you know, glance in that direction a couple times. And it also looks like whoever shot it got kind of close. And it's hard to tell whether there's a fence there, right? And it seems like in the footage that it's almost like looks over the fence at one point. It's hard to tell whether the person was in a car or was walking or what. But sure enough, yeah, one of the things that really surprised me is the lack of reaction by the officers, which, you know, makes it really hard to tell whether they knew this was being filmed or not.
And just to clarify the Supreme Court ruling that I referred to a moment ago, Corey Hutchins, the ruling was Tennessee versus Garner. It was a case in which the Supreme Court held that under the Fourth Amendment, when a law enforcement officer is pursuing a fleeing suspect, he or she may not use deadly force to prevent escape unless the officer has probable cause to believe that the suspect poses a significant threat of death or serious physical injury to the officer or others. So those are the parameters of the law, I guess, in this case. And
right,
judging by the video, it didn't seem like the officer was his life was under threat. The man was unarmed when he was shot.
Well, I think he'll be a good attorney.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Corey Hutchins.
Thanks for reaching out. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Corey Hutchins, who's a freelance journalist and a former staff writer for the Columbia Free Times, South Carolina's largest weekly newspaper. He was the 2008 winner of the South Carolina Press Association's Award for In-Depth Reporting and was the winner of their Journalist of the Year Award in 2012. He's the author of The Accidental Candidate, about the mystery candidate for the U.S. Senate, Alvin Green. And his latest exclusive is Michael Slager's attorney dumped him as soon as he saw video, which is up now at The Daily Beast. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into similarities between North Charleston and Ferguson, Missouri.
All the families and the students all confused and hardy, weeping through each other's arms. It's murder. New absence in the mother's arms. Even the warmth of a mother's arms could not keep a son from harm. Standing where the gun was drawn, overcome, done and done, he gone. Murder. chill shell like a bell and run. The blood burst, body temperature fell and plunged. And in the time it took the medics to come, the breath eased out of his lungs. And the soul.
Are you really for peace and equality? Or when my car's hooked up, you know you wanna follow me. Your laws are minimal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bernard Powers, a professor of history at the College of Charleston, who has published numerous works on African-American social and cultural evolution. He was associate editor for the South Carolina Encyclopedia and is the author of Black Charlestonians, A Social History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bernard Powers.
Well, thank you, Ian. Thank you for having me.
And I wish it were under better circumstances, given the shooting death of Walter Scott, which many of our listeners have already seen the video. And it does seem that the video made all of the difference here, because prior to the release of the video, the police department, according to reports in the local newspaper, basically suggested that the victim was at fault and gave no details of what really happened. In fact, they gave the opposite impression. So do you see this as a case where, but for the video, we would have had a very different outcome?
Oh, I'm sure the outcome would have been very different. And this shows the important relationship that the technology has to important current events, particularly those that have a bearing on race. We give police officers a good deal of latitude in what they can do with the badges and weapons. Without that video, it would have been the policeman's word that would have been accepted, and the case basically would have been closed. You know, the other thing that this reminds me of is this, Ian. When you think about perhaps 60 years earlier, it was the presence of the television camera that had so much to do with the success of the civil rights movement in the 1960s. Because what was happening, for example, on the streets of Birmingham and other places simply couldn't be denied, and it was broadcast around the world in the same way that this video really provided us with the crucial information that led to the charges being brought against this policeman.
And, of course, without being a contrarian, here in Los Angeles, you had the police beating of Rodney King that was graphically shown on television. But nevertheless,
that's right.
The police were acquitted. And that, of course, led to enormous riots here. So that's another way of saying, you know, there's a movement out now called Black Lives Matter, and it seems like we need that movement more than ever.
We certainly do. We certainly do. Just to harken back a few years, there were those people who believed that with the election of a black president, we would enter into a new era of post-racialism. Well, it hasn't happened yet.
So as a citizen of Charleston, South Carolina, Bernard Powers, tell us about North Charleston.
Well, North Charleston is the city immediately adjacent to us in the north. It is a city that is smaller than the city of Charleston. It is more industrialized. It's more working class. The socioeconomic indices generally would be lower than those that you would find in the city of Charleston proper. However, it's a diverse community. There are lots of nice neighborhoods there also, but it's a much more industrialized sector with a much larger working class population there. Lots of African Americans reside in North Charleston also, And one of the things that has been happening here, really for the in the city of Charleston, is that for the past few decades, we have seen a tremendous process of gentrification, particularly in the downtown area, which has changed the racial composition of the city of Charleston over time. And as housing prices and taxes continue to steadily go up, what it's meant is that the black population has exited the city of Charleston, and many people have moved up to the adjacent city of North Charleston, where the taxes are lower and the property values in general are lower also. Housing is more affordable up there.
Again, I'm speaking with Bernard Powers, who's a professor of history at the College of Charleston, who has published numerous works on African-American social and cultural evolution. He was associate editor for the South Carolina Encyclopedia and is the author of Black Charlestonians, A Social History. So there does seem to be some unfortunate analogies here, Bernard, with what happened in Ferguson, Missouri, in the sense that we know that that was a predominantly African-American community. Nevertheless, there were very few African-Americans on the police force and even fewer on the city council. In North Charleston, the police department is 80% white, and there are only 37% of the North Charleston are white residents. And contrasting to that, the African-American population of North Charleston is about 47%. So it's not quite as disparate as the statistics from Ferguson, but it still shows, at least in terms of the police, a predominantly white police force policing a predominantly African-American community.
Sure, sure. And there are those kinds of similarities, and that has, over the years, bred some real mistrust between the residents and the police department up there. In fact, the NAACP has routinely raised questions about the use of excessive force in the police department, and also has raised questions about racial profiling in the city of North Charleston. So there clearly are issues of race that have been on the front burner there for a number of years. Now, where one of the differences between Ferguson and North Charleston comes up is that the African-American population has been politically involved in North Charleston and has had representation on the city council up there for a number of years, and has had some quite vocal representatives up there.
So in terms of what we know about this situation, in Ferguson, for example, they just had elections where the African-American representation on the council has increased. So there was obviously a political awakening, if you will. What's your sense about the demonstrations that are taking place today in North Charleston? Do you feel that this is going to have a similar effect? Do you think that there will be anything like what we saw in Ferguson in terms of an angry response?
Well, I think that while there have been some shrill and loud voices raised today, the swiftness with which the authorities in the police department and the mayor acted in this case, I think will be generally disarming to many of the detractors there in North Charleston. Now, that's not to dismiss the systemic problems that you have identified, but I think that's one of the main differences, and one of the things that the police department and the municipal government has going for it up there. In other words, there's not going to be this long period of time which lags between the incident and the dissemination of information. For such a long period of time there in Ferguson, the officer's name was not released. There was no information with regard to whether there would be any charges, what the nature of the charges might be. And it's in that interval period that the opportunity for mistrust and anger and hostility can build and can reach a boiling point. The other thing I think too is that with regard to that situation in Ferguson, there was so much additional information that came out, really indicting city officials there, members of the police department, the racist emails, the way in which the ticketing situation had in a grossly disproportionate way caught African Americans up in a kind of a dragnet, draining them financially to support the city. And so all of those things, I think, taken together really pushed people to the brink, in which they went out into massive street activism. And I think the situation will be very different there in North Charleston. Already there are some people on the city council that have some African Americans on the city council have praised the mayor and the head of the police department for the swiftness and the decisiveness with which they have acted already. And I think it's going to be that effort, along with the effort of the mayor, for example, meeting with the family of Walter Scott today and embracing them, that will create a situation that will be much more manageable and constructive.
Well, obviously, again, the video made all the difference, because
yes,
prior to the release of the video on Tuesday, prior to that, the incident happened on Saturday morning, and Saturday afternoon, the police issued a statement exonerating the officer. The local newspaper, the Post and Courier, carried a story saying the dead man fought with an officer over his taser before deadly force was employed. During the struggle, the man gained control of the taser and attempted to use it against the officer. The officer then resorted to his service weapon and shot him. A very different story, of course,
yep,
has emerged when you see the videotape. You actually see the officer pick up the taser from the spot where he fired his weapon into the back, 8 times into the back of the fleeing suspect. And then he goes over to the body and drops the, appears to drop the taser beside the body. And we know that there is a Supreme Court ruling that says that police officers cannot use deadly force on fleeing suspects unless the suspect is a danger to the police officer or to others. And
that's right.
Doesn't look like that applies in this situation. So,
that's right.
Again, we have to be grateful for that citizen who took that video.
Yes, absolutely. And it was an act of courageousness to do so and to continue doing so. And at one point, it looked like, and this may not be correct, but it looked like the officer glanced over in the direction of the person doing the filming, but he maintained a steady grip and continued to film it. And also, thank goodness that he had the foresight to and the insight to turn it over to the family, so that the family had that piece of evidence, and they were able to use it to their advantage and ultimately to the advantage of the community that they're a part of.
So it does seem as though the victim in this case, he had had problems with child support, and there was an outstanding warrant to failure to pay. He did have a job. He'd bought a used Mercedes from a neighbor. He was apparently going to buy parts. Apparently he was in a pawn shop just before this happened. The general impression that I get is that this was a man who's struggling, not a wealthy person. And, you know, there is a sense, particularly that we learn from Ferguson, there's a kind of a criminalization of the poor that's going on in this country with excessive tickets. This guy got a ticket for a broken taillight, which is, you know, not exactly a capital offense.
That's right. Exactly. And I just don't think that is something that the police generally will stop you for. They normally have other more pressing concerns than that. But I think you're absolutely right. And the irony here is that it may very well have been correct that he was going to have the car fixed, get the part, and so on and so forth. And yet he ends up losing his life in this very tragic situation that unfolded.
Well, just in closing, Bernard Powers, as a resident of Charleston, and Charleston, I guess, goes down in history as the place where the Civil War began.
Yes.
What's your sense of race relations? The extent to which this is yet again a white police officer shooting an unarmed black man, a very clearly explosive and incendiary issue in the country, and one that has yet to be resolved.
Sure. Well, I think that what it reveals is when you take this most latest piece of evidence and you combine it with all the other things that we have seen, it is highly suggestive of what people have been saying for a long time and have been studying for a long time, and that there is a systemic problem in the way that the criminal justice system operates, and that there's a systemic problem in the way in which police departments engage with African American residents. And so it really is time is long overdue for there to be in cases like Ferguson and here special efforts made to recruit more African American police officers, to improve the training of police personnel at every level in terms of cultural sensitivity, but also in terms of when and how to use deadly force, because we have seen over and over and over again in so many cases black lives taken unjustifiably or people harmed when they should not have been, because in this state we saw only months ago an African American fellow who had been stopped up in Columbia. The officer asked him to get his wallet. The man begins to do so, and the police officer then begins to shoot him. And this is caught on videotape also.
Well, Bernard Powers, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. Appreciate the opportunity and wish you well.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Bernard Powers, who's a professor of history at the College of Charleston, who has published numerous works on African-American social and cultural evolution. He was associate editor for the South Carolina Encyclopedia and is the author of Black Charlestonians, A Social History. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the criminalization of poverty.
Because a few of them were white, and it's the same across the nation. Black and white discrimination. Yeah, and you can't understand me, and all that other jazz they hand me in the papers and TV, and all that mass stupidity that seems to grow more every day. Each time you hear something we'd say, he wants to go and do you in. Cause the color of your skin just don't appeal to him, no matter if it's black or white, because he's out for blood tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Karen Dolan, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, whose work focuses on anti-poverty issues, local democracy and empowerment, and peace. She currently coordinates the Economic Hardship Reporting Project with the New York Times bestselling author Barbara Ehrenreich, and is the author of a new report at the Institute for Policy Studies, The Poor Get Prison, The Alarming Spread of the Criminalization of Poverty. Welcome to Background Briefing, Karen Dolan.
Thank you, Ian. Pleasure to be here.
And in terms of the latest incident in the context of the Black Lives Matter movement, where I think most of the nation have seen the videotape, or at least had access to the videotape, that completely turned this situation around, since it's pretty clear that this officer shoots a fleeing black man in the back 8 times and kills him. What is the connection here in terms of the victim's poverty? He apparently had a job, and he'd been arrested a number of times for failure to pay child support. Would you consider this another example of the criminalization of the poor?
It's hard to know the exact details, but in an area of high poverty, there is a higher incidence of targeting and pursuing people for minor traffic violations, such as the broken taillight that Mr. Scott was pulled over for, coupled with the fact that he had apparently an outstanding warrant for unpaid child support. You can imagine this is the kind of scenario that has happened thousands of times in cities across the country, more and more since the recession. And this seems like it could be another incident of that. He, yes, has had a new job for about 9 months. And as the reports were, he was trying to get his life back on track. But with any type of debt, as well with child support debt, these things can build over time. It's very easy for a debt to get out of control. And when a debt becomes the basis for repeated arrests, you know that something's wrong.
Well, I guess a fair question to ask was, how many white people do you know that get arrested for failure to pay child support? Is it common? Is there a disparity there in whether poor black people get arrested more for failure to support their children than, say, poor white people or even rich white people?
Well, I don't have the statistics with regard to child support, but we do know that with misdemeanor traffic violations, that black men are 4 times as likely to be pulled over for things such as a broken taillight or a traffic violation than white people are. And we do know that in general, with debts and fines and fees for misdemeanor crimes, black men are more likely to be incarcerated than white men.
Well, we do know that the victim was at the pawn shop. He was leaving the pawn shop when he had the confrontation with the police officer. So I think it's pretty clear, isn't it, that poor people tend to use pawn shops as a form of money of last resort.
Yes, and North Charleston, South Carolina, has a poverty rate over 22%. So it's a high poverty area. And it is typical and increasingly more and more typical that minor traffic violations result in either spiraling debt or incarceration, or oftentimes, or I should say, more often than with white people, if the person pulled over is a black male, a violence can be the result perpetrated against the person pulled over.
Well, we know from the demographics of North Charleston, South Carolina, that there are certainly some echoes of Ferguson, Missouri. The South Carolina Police Department is 80% white in a town that only has 37% of white residents with 47% black residents. So there's already disparity there. It's not quite as stark as the one in Ferguson. So what do you make of that?
That's right. So I think you have to look at the two factors together. One that is sort of widespread across the country that affects white poor people, black poor people, Latino poor people, is this increasing kind of dragnet, if you will, that captures more and more people in this net of trying to extract fines and fees to make up for squeezed budgets at the local level and sometimes at the state level that has happened since the recession. So white and black and brown people get drawn into that, but there is a disproportionate number of especially black males. So then when you overlay it with racial profiling that has been documented in places where the imbalance between the criminal justice, the police department, and the citizenship, as in Ferguson, as in North Charleston, you've got almost a perfect storm that's going on. But what you have sort of underneath that is you already have a police department as a Department of Justice investigation really highlighted in Ferguson. You have a police department that is in the service of extracting revenue from the residents rather than performing public safety. So you have a police department that is set to look at the citizens as if they are criminals who can be shaken down for money to go into the city coffers rather than a group of people that they're trying to protect. When you have racial tensions layered on top of that, you get what happened this weekend, unfortunately, with Walter Scott.
And again, I'm speaking with Karen Dolan, who's a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, whose work focuses on anti-poverty issues, local democracy, and empowerment and peace. She currently coordinates the Economic Hardship Reporting Project with New York Times bestselling author Barbara Ehrenreich, and is the author of the new report at the Institute for Policy Studies, The Poor Get Prison, The Alarming Spread of the Criminalization of Poverty. Now, in terms of the DOJ report that you just mentioned on Ferguson that found that black residents were unfairly targeted for minor offenses and they were basically being shaken down for city revenues. Similarly, in 2012, the local paper in Charleston, South Carolina, the Post Courier, documented the rise of complaints from black residents in North Charleston who said they were being discriminated against and arrested for low-level crimes. And the paper documented the case of Jamie Roper, a North Charleston police officer, first stopped Jamie Roper in the front yard of his Westview Street home. Roper had been speeding through the neighborhood just moments earlier, the officer said, and Roper got a ticket for reckless driving. And weeks later, Roper was inside a barbershop when he got another citation. When he walked outside, the same officer wrote him up for having loud music in his restored 1987 Chevrolet Camaro. And the officer spoke to him, as according to Roper, as if he weren't human. He said he was going to get me. He said he was going to put his police dog on me. That's obviously, somewhat anecdotal, but it is, after all, published in the local newspaper. So do you have any more information on these analogies between North Charleston and Ferguson?
Well, just that what our report found is that there is an increase. There has been an increase in prosecuting people for misdemeanor municipal code violations since the recession. So since 2008, since 2009, when we see especially in poor communities, city budgets are squeezed and they don't have the revenue of, say, a more wealthy community that has higher property tax revenues. We have seen, as in Ferguson, the police department is instructed to, fill up that pad with tickets. You know, make sure that pad is gone by the end of the day, that you've written out the tickets, that you've brought in the money. And you found in Ferguson, and this is indicative of other low-income areas, including, I assume, North Charleston, South Carolina. The police departments and the court systems are looking more and more to bringing in revenues for these minor infractions and adding fees on top of debts, on top of fines. And it's terrible fiscal policy, but it puts the onus on the backs of poor people. That's good for politicians. It's not raising taxes, and it's hard to raise taxes in low-income areas. So there's lots of reasons that this is happening. But when it dovetails with both this culture that we have in this country that poor people are somehow responsible for their own misery, and that black people, especially black men, are criminals from preschool, where they're targeted in school systems, where young black men, black boys, children, are disproportionately handed over to police for childish behavior. We have a real crisis in this country.
So debtors' prisons, of course, were outlawed in the last century, but I guess your new report, Karen Dolan, The Poor Get Prison, The Alarming Spread of the Criminalization of Poverty, it would suggest that debtors' prisons are coming back because people are, in fact, going to prison for their inability to pay fines. And the report also points out that the excessive punishment of poor children helps create the school-to-prison pipeline, and the increase in arrests of homeless people and people feeding the homeless is criminalizing the misfortune of others. I've done some interviews with people who actually got arrested for feeding the poor, and it does make you wonder about our society in terms of its compassion index, I guess would be the way to put it. So have you seen a rise? Does your report indicate that the trends are going in this callous direction?
Yes, it does. And it's harder to see because when you look sort of at the overall incarceration rate, that's been going down and violent crime has been going down. But what has been going up is this attack on the poor. So again, the fines and the fees, and yes, debtor prisons were made illegal in the 1800s. You know, we don't live in Charles Dickens' London. Yet and still, people are going to jail more and more for nothing other than owing money. Many judges are skipping over the ability to pay hearing and making summary judgments themselves on someone's ability to pay. And we have more and more an offender-funded justice system where people who are charged have to pay application fees for a public defender, or have to pay a private probation company, have to pay room and board if they're incarcerated. And the families, are saddled with this debt. And we have a culture that has picked up, at least conservative talking points that poor people somehow are responsible for this themselves. I think that's perhaps, this is a conjecture on my part, that this is one of the ways that policies like this can be passed and sustained, is if we create this idea that poor people are responsible for their own poverty. Otherwise, I don't see how people could still maintain this idea that we live in a decent society.
And is there a correlation in the statistics that you've looked at, Karen Dolan, between whether the poor vote and their marginalization and criminalization? Because we learned from Ferguson that when it was revealed that this predominantly black community was represented by an almost entirely white council, then that became pretty stark. My understanding is they've just had elections and that has changed because the African American majority actually came out and voted. So the connection was made there. But is there a connection?
Yes. So you see in disenfranchised communities, and lots of times people have lost their right to vote, have become disenfranchised when they come out of prison for certain convictions, even though they've done the time. This is where people like Michelle Alexander, who's written The New Jim Crow, and people who talk about these New Jim Crow laws bring this up, that, the right to vote has been denied, or the right to really reentering society as a full citizen once someone has done their time. So you see the barriers that are placed on people from being poor, You can't take off work necessarily to go and vote. You feel disenfranchised. You don't see people running for office who reflect your demographic or that are expressing your needs. So we had a higher turnout in Ferguson for the election yesterday because there were some African-American candidates who were running and who were running on the issues that were brought to the fore by the tragedy in Ferguson. So there's many reasons, and then the new voter ID laws, there's all kinds of obstacles that are much more difficult to overcome for low-income people than it is for people in middle and upper classes. So that is reflected in who even runs for office, never mind who gets elected.
So in terms of if, as I say, in Ferguson at least, there's been a sort of wake-up call following the lack of representation of the black majority. Is there a way to organize the poor in this country?
I think there are a lot of organizations and movements, especially movements led by formerly incarcerated people. There's an organization called All of Us or None in San Francisco that spearheaded this Ban the Box movement that has really taken off and is in many cities across the country that takes off that little box that you have to check at when you're applying for a job that says, have you ever been arrested or convicted? And so there are these movements, and they're especially strong when they're led by people who have lived this experience. There's the Color of Change organization, there's the Sentencing Project, there are the people who've organized Black Lives Matter and the people who've sort of taken off from Black Lives Matter. There's a lot of interfaith organizations, there's a lot of worker rights organizations. So there's a lot of movement and a lot of hope that people who are experiencing these hardships and obstacles are suggesting the policy changes and are on the streets and, you know, on the airwaves increasingly being heard. So I do see hope in that. But again, it's a really tough row to hoe, and the obstacles are much, much higher for people without resources.
Well, Karen Dolan, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Karen Dolan, who's a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, whose work focuses on anti-poverty issues, local democracy and empowerment and peace. She currently coordinates the Economic Hardship Reporting Project with New York Times bestselling author Barbara Ehrenreich and is the author of the new report at the Institute for Policy Studies, The Poor Get Prison, The Alarming Spread of the Criminalization of Poverty. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.